And Jerry. Welcome, everybody, to the February 15th, 2017 session of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a full agenda today, and we're going to start off with that. There it is. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 256. Patrick.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 2256 establishes Willamette Falls Locks Commission as a policymaking advisory board for issues related to the repair, reopening, operation, maintenance, and future transfer of ownership of the Willamette River National Navigational Channel and Lock System. It establishes the Willamette Falls Navigation Infrastructure Program to provide support and assistance to the commission, and establishes the Willamette Falls Navigation Infrastructure Program account and appropriates $677,500. General fund into the account. All three programs sunset December 1st, 2023. It has an emergency clause that would become effective upon passage. We have received, Mr. Chair, a fiscal light statement for this that for purposes of referring the bill to the Ways and Means Committee, and a minimal revenue impact statement, Mr. Chair. And
thank you, Patrick. This is not the first time we've had this one in front of us. We did last time. We will start off with first inviting up the Honorable Barbara Roberts, Governor. Welcome to our committee. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Senator. Does it matter where the mics are?
Not a bit.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, first Chairman Dwyer and members of the committee. For the record, I am Governor Barbara Roberts, and I was the convener of the task force that was established by this body in the 2015 legislative session. We charged that committee, that task force, to develop findings and recommendations for the repair and the reopening of the Willamette Falls locks, and we have done that, which is why I am speaking to you today. First, I would like to thank the legislators who participated in that work, Senators Devlin and Olson, and Representatives Parrish and Barton from the legislature as well. And I'd like to thank representatives from Oregon Transportation, Parks, Travel Oregon, and the Marine Board for their contributions and insights. And then there's also some thanks that was earned by representatives from local government, the Grand Ronde Tribes, the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers, and members of the community. And so it was with all that input and expertise that we developed the recommendation we are submitting to the 2017 legislature for consideration in the form of Senate Bill 256. Several of you are sponsors of the bill, and we appreciate your support. The principal conclusion of the task force embodied in Senate Bill 256 is to establish a state commission with the clear charge to determine the future for the locks, with the likely result of being a transfer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to a new entity such as the state or local government, a special district, maybe even a consortium. So I would like to elaborate on the need and the importance of following through on this recommendation. The Federal Corps of Engineers has initiated a formal disposition study wherein they will carry out their due diligence to inform their decision on the future of the locks. There needs to be an entity to be the non-federal sponsor with the clear line of authority and communication to interface with the Corps. The task force concluded this responsibility doesn't fit squarely within the responsibility of any single existing state or local organization, and therefore we recommend that a new commission be formed to represent the interests of local and regional governments, the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, businesses, and the state. At the state level, it is envisioned that two state agencies would be present and part represent the aspects that the locks represent to Oregonians and things Oregonians care about. Oregonians care about our cultural heritage and history. So State Parks has an interest in preserving the locks for our citizens and also for the economic potential from cultural tourism. Business Oregon has an interest in the locks for tourism, as well as the movement of commerce on the Willamette and future economic potential from the possibility of inland ports. ODOT has an interest in the marine transportation of goods and also the potential of using the river as a transportation route in the event of a catastrophic event. The Marine Board has an interest for boating and recreational watercraft. So I guess I could say, as governor, I led these agencies, and I understand how difficult it is to bring different departments and agencies together, but how important it is for our state that we facilitate this collaboration for a project that has this much significance, and it crosses departmental lines. The window of opportunity is here and now. The locks have deteriorated since they were closed in 2011. The Corps of Engineers is bound by federal laws to invest in marine navigation facilities that produce economic benefit of national significance. With the shrinkage of the timber industry, there is no longer the movement, that huge movement of tonnage of logs that came downriver through the locks. As a result, it is the intent of the Corps to dispose of this facility either to another federal, state, or local entity, or through dismantling it or disposal on the open market as surplus property. That was their plan. Well, we have worked closely with the Corps district and the national headquarters leadership working together toward an acceptable conclusion for the locks. It is vital for our region that we carry out our own due diligence to inform our decision on the future of the locks while participating fully at the same time with the Corps' efforts. We need to understand the engineering issues, the status of the title to the property, the cost, the environmental consequences, and options for determining a transferee plus a funding source to repair and operate the facility. It is not sufficient to simply wait and have the Corps hand us their conclusion. Plus, we now have supportive federal legislation in place thanks to the hard work of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. In the waning hours of the 114th Congress, the Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation Act, that's a mouthful, now called the WIN Act, was signed into law by the outgoing President Obama. Within that legislation is a section 1165, directing the Corps of Engineers, in case of disposition studies, to, and I'm going to quote, to consider the extent to which the property concerned has economic, cultural, historic, or recreational significance or impacts at the national, state, and local level, unquote. The key question for the disposition study is the level of funding the Corps will contribute towards repair of the facility that they want to transfer to another party. In this new act, the language directs them to use a new standard. A state commission should be in place so that our local and state interests are united, and also that we have the opportunity to pursue and to influence this new standard that has been set, that it is more than just a national economic factor. There are local, state, and regional economic factors as well. The locks are 143 years old, and they are a national treasure. The locks have value for their place in history and in its cultural significance. However, the locks also present an opportunity for economic development in the region, especially when you consider the combination of the locks and the legacy project across the river at the former Blue Heron site. Yeah. Those two pieces together are extraordinary, and an extraordinary opportunity. But the timing is crucial for Oregon. With the repair and the reopening of the locks, the Willamette River will once again be navigable above the falls. We are the stewards of this treasure, and together with a Willamette Falls Locks Commission and the passage of this bill that is before you, we can move forward. This is an opportunity I believe we cannot let slip away. I want to thank you for your attention and thank you for hopefully a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 256. We look forward to working with you, knowing this is a tough session economically, but this is a critical and really important timing issue for the locks at Willamette Falls.
Thank you, Governor. Any questions of Governor Roberts?
Thank you very much for
thank
coming down and joining
much.
Us.
Congresswoman Hooley, am I correct in protocol that you want to bat last? I don't want to go outside of protocol here. You're okay with that?
He said you can bat cleanup.
Okay. She's batting cleanup.
I'm going to bat.
Okay. I got it. Senator Devlin, Senator Olson. Welcome, gentlemen. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator representing Senate District 20, the heart of Clackamas County. The Willamette Falls area has a long and prestigious history for the state of Oregon. Willamette Falls itself is 42 feet high and 1,500 feet wide. Willamette Falls itself is the second largest waterfall in America, behind Niagara Falls, for the volume of water that goes over the falls. So we have a little bit of history there. The Willamette Falls Canal and Locks Company, later renamed Portland General Electric, was formed in 1868 and built to build a navigation route around the falls. Construction then began in building a canal and lock system around the west end of the falls. The locks actually opened about 4 years before Senator Monroe became a legislator. In 1873. And it's the first multi-lift navigation locks in the United States, and it was built at a cost of $560,000. It was in continuous use until 2008. Maria Wilkins, a steamship, was the first vessel to use the locks. The Army Corps of Engineers purchased a lock system from Portland General Electric in 1915 for $375,000. The locks were then added to the National Register of Historic Places. The locks are operated by the United States Corps of Army Engineers and serve primarily pleasure boats. With no funding available to perform needed inspection and repairs, the locks were closed in January of 2008. In April 2009, as part of the federal government economic stimulus plan, $1.8 million was allocated to repair and inspect the locks, with an additional $900,000 allocated in October of 2009 for additional repairs and operational costs. The locks reopened in January 2010 with the Willamette Queen, the first vessel to pass. The locks were open through the summer of 2010, and then due to the lack of federal funding for operations, were not scheduled to reopen for 2011. The interesting thing is that they permanently closed the locks due to lack of traffic, but traffic couldn't use the locks because the locks were not operational. Until closure, the locks were used for hauling log rafts, barges moving sand and gravel, moving the Spruce Goose to McMinnville, allowing the Canby Ferry to go down to Dry Dock in Portland to get repaired, and most important, allowing me to launch my boat near my home and go down the Willamette River to the Columbia so I could fish. I wanted to speak to the history of the falls to show how important this area, including the locks, are to our heritage. With this legislation, we will be able to eventually restore the locks to the greatness it once enjoyed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I think actually that former Governor Roberts and Senator Olson have done an excellent job of presenting this. I'm hoping I'm not going to be too redundant, but there are some things I just wanted to put on the record. They're not as interesting as the historical facts that Senator Olson cited, nor are they as broad as all of the factors that Governor Roberts cited. Today, I'm here to speak in favor of SB 256 on reopening the Willamette Falls locks. I would also like to thank this committee for recommending the passage of SB 131 in the 2015 session, as it established the state task force, which has now completed its recommendations and laid the groundwork for this bill, SB 256. Mr. Chairman and all members of the committee here, many of you have served on task forces before. I will tell you that this is one of the best staffed and actually best attended task forces I have ever been part of. And I don't think I have enough pages here to list all the task forces that I have been assigned to. I would also like to thank Governor Roberts for her advocacy and for being the convener of this task force, because she was instrumental, obviously, in having that good attendance and actually ensuring that our staff work was done quite well. And I think it's something that we all should be proud of. As a state, you know, the Willamette Falls, as portion of this, you know, is the second largest waterfall by volume in the nation. And the history of the Willamette Falls locks and the history of the Willamette Falls, both in terms of the history of this state, but particularly in the history of tribal nations, particularly in terms of Willamette Falls, is rich in something that should be endure and should be actually improved upon so that people understand how this state actually emerged and why at one time Oregon City was the territorial capital. Yeah. The entities that have been involved in this have been involved very diligently. Metro, Clackamas County, West Lynn, other local governments, businesses, tribal advocates have been united in their advocacy for the repair and reopening of the Willamette Falls locks. Reopening the locks provides a great opportunity for our economy, including increased commerce and tourism, as well as recreational, cultural, historic, transportation, and other opportunities. SB 256 implements the recommendations of the task force. It has two main parts. The first would establish a Willamette Falls Locks Commission. The 11-member commission would be represented by members of state parks, the Oregon Department of Transportation, tribal governments, local governments, and other businesses and stakeholders, as well as two members from local chambers of commerce. This bill would bring all these interests in the locks together in a collaborative process to work together to negotiate the ultimate disposition of the locks with the Army Corps of Engineers on behalf of the citizens of the state of Oregon. The second part of SB 266 would set aside $677,500 to coordinate efforts to repair, reopen, and maintain the locks. In this time of a severe budget challenges, you may ask why I'm here supporting this bill, particularly in the position that I've been appointed to. Reopening the locks is in a way a now or never opportunity. Yeah. The Army Corps of Engineers is proceeding with its disposition deliberations and that process. If we do not have someone to negotiate with them and clearly identify the way that the locks can be maintained in the future and perhaps take actually control of the locks and operate them in the future, it's very possible that the Corps of Engineers will dispose of the locks. You've heard all of the alternatives. One of the alternatives wasn't probably defined as explicitly as it possibly could. One of the alternatives would simply be to fill in the locks permanently, and that would in effect lose them forever as a means of transportation on the river, as a means of going from one level of the river to the other. It would also make it very difficult for future generations to understand the historical significance of the locks. It's always a factor when you're trying to teach history. It's much easier when you can actually show something that still exists than talk about something that existed, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, particularly something like this that has existed for over 140 years. Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask this committee to forward this on with a due pass recommendation to the full Ways and Means Committee. If you do hear about any concerns about this bill, I will tell you that there are a lot of people working on this bill, and they are very committed to resolving any issues before this bill comes out of that full committee and before it goes to the two chambers. Because the most important thing we want, because we think of how important this is for the people of Oregon, although in some respects people might think of this as a minor issue, it is at the core of our history as a state. We want to bring this to both chambers and have the strongest possible votes from both chambers on this bill so that we can clearly present to the Corps of Engineers why the future of the Willamette Locks is so important to this state and so important to the people of this state.
Thank you, Senators. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. And now, let's see, we have Representative Kennemer, Meek, and Power. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, thank you. Vice Chair Thompson, committee members, for the record, my name is Mark Meek. I'm representative of House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone. And I'm here as both a citizen of the area and also part of my work on the as a vice chair of the House Transportation Policy Committee. I recognize that the opportunity to reopen the locks for commerce would relieve congestion on our roads also. Many people don't know that the Westland Paper Company is adjacent to the locks and is the oldest active paper mill in the western United States with good paying jobs. Westland and other businesses have expressed their interest in the river for transporting goods, but the locks would need to be reopened with reliability. And in order for those businesses to switch over, they're going to need that guaranteed reliability. Also, as a member of the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, I recognize that the locks are also a potential transportation route after an earthquake or a catastrophic event if they are repaired with seismic upgrades. The locks do not fit neatly under the jurisdiction of a single state agency or a department. So the commission, I believe, is needed to bring together both state parks, ODOT, the Marine Board, and Business Oregon to join the tribal, regional, and local governments, business, and advocates to develop solutions for the repair and continued operation for the locks. So is that the reason I'm here today, is to recommend a do pass and hopefully gain your support and get support on the House side. So respectfully yours, Mark Meek. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Karin Power. I am the newly elected state representative for House District 41. I represent Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and a little bit of Southeast Portland. Both Mark and I are technically in other committees at the moment, so thank you for letting us move up a little bit. I wanted to come and share with you a little bit of my experiences and work on behalf of this project to date. As a city councilor in Milwaukee, I was a former member of the Willamette Locks, Falls Locks Working Group, and it was my great pleasure to work with a number of these folks in helping to advance this project at the local level. The locks are important to our entire region. I wanted to come personally and lend my support because the state has already invested resources in upgrading our boating and recreational access along the Willamette River. Specifically, Milwaukee has a new boat ramp and is quite popular with boaters. This presents the last obstacle to really utilizing the entire Willamette River. It would afford just tremendous opportunities for tourism and recreation in our region, in addition to the transportation points that my colleague just touched on. Alongside the Legacy Project and the forthcoming public access to the falls, reopening the locks just provides a major economic opportunity for our region that is important to all of our cities and our counties. Tourism, including both the cultural tourism and the historic tourism related to the locks, would be a major economic driver in areas where, you know, we could really use a little extra dollars investing into our local communities. If you haven't had an opportunity to do so and been to the falls, they are an absolute scenic wonder. The Oregon City efforts to revitalize the Blue Heron former paper mill site with that nexus with the falls legacy work and the locks, I think, are one of the most exciting opportunities for our state right now. I would ask you to support this bill as Mark and I work with Bill, too, on our House side. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39, parts of South Clackamas County. I think nearly everything I've wanted to say has been already said. But a couple of things. One is, this is a fabulous treasure, and we locals, we Oregonians, and nationally do treasure it, and I think we need to take good care of it. The second thing is, it has enormous support, whether it's Governor Roberts or Congressman Hooley or former Representative Nato or all the rest of us. It's tremendous broad-based support, bipartisan. It's a great idea. It'll be a neat economic boon to our area. And I probably need to give a slight disclaimer, about 4 miles south of there. And if you need to visit it and have a closer examination from the upside, since we can't get to the downside, I'd be happy to give you a boat ride and maybe even take a beverage if we needed it.
Trying to bribe the committee, huh?
Under
it was a tourism.
any questions of this panel? Thank you, representatives. Most appreciated. Okay, now we have Councillor Collette, Commissioner Schrader, and Mayor Axelrod. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Thompson and members of the committee. I'm Carlotta Collette. I'm on the Metro Council, and I serve in District 2, which includes the Willamette Falls, the Locks, West Lynn, Oregon City, that part of the region that we're talking about today. I wanted to point out that we do have a letter, I think you've been given copies of it, of support from the Metro Council for this project. We have also been one of the financing groups that has helped support the working group, and we're committed to helping to match the funds that the state would provide, hopefully through this piece of legislation. You've heard today how important a site Willamette Falls is. It is really one of those places that is first for everything. It's one of the first seats of government on the West Coast, first long-distance electric transmission in the world. I mean, there's just so many firsts about that site that we've all kind of ignored all of this time. I wanted to say, though, that the state of Oregon has been a partner in building the locks right from the beginning. In 1868, when the locks were proposed, the state legislature came forward with $200,000 out of what we've heard was a little bit over $500,000 to build it. The state came through. The state helped buy it when it was sold from a private to a federal agency. The state helped provide some of that funding so that it could become toll-free. And then in 2015, as you've heard, the state appropriated dollars to help us to form the task force, which many of us served on, along with supporting the Willamette Falls National Heritage and a letter of support for the legacy project, the mill site renovation in Oregon City. It was 2016, when the legislature provided the funding for the task force. So our vision really is bigger than just the locks, and trying to be clear with people about how this is such a huge opportunity of a real weave of amazing projects, I think, is one of the things that we want to communicate today, that we're working on the Riverwalk on the Willamette Falls side. We're working on getting the whole area to be a National Heritage Site, and it was the first state heritage site, so we're thankful for that. But we're also working on the opportunity to repair and reopen those locks, because they really do provide all the values you've heard about today. So this is it's a huge opportunity. We feel that it's the catalyst for that whole part of our region, and obviously then for the whole state. So I'm also joining my colleagues today in asking you to do a do pass recommendation on Senate Bill 256. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee who I've all known for quite a while, it's a
pleasure
to be here today. I appreciate your willingness to consider Senate Bill 256 and hearing my testimony and those of my colleagues. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 256, which will create a state commission to represent the local interest of the Willamette Falls locks while the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers works to dispose of the facility. The locks at Willamette Falls are important for three main reasons: heritage, tourism, and recreation, as well as supporting local businesses. If the locks only met one of these needs, you would not see the coalition of support advocating so strongly for this next step in the history of the locks. Now, I can only imagine that with all this local support, you're asking yourselves this very important and critical question: is a state commission necessary for the Willamette Falls locks? And I would say unequivocally, yes, it is absolutely necessary. The bottom line is the Army Corps of Engineers is far more responsive, efficient, and more collaborative when states are involved in these types of projects. And take it from me, I've been to Washington, D.C. numerous times, not only met with our congressional delegation, but also met with members of the Army Corps of Engineers, and have really said, we can be creative, we can do this. One successful example is the locks at Fox River in Wisconsin. When the state became involved, the Corps worked with the state to help find a solution that worked for everyone. Other facilities haven't been as fortunate. The series of locks and dams on the Green and Barren Rivers in Kentucky are great examples of where the Corps simply walked away when they decided there was no longer federal interest in the facilities. We don't want that to happen here. I have utmost respect for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They have a massive inventory. They're mandated by federal law to seek out national economic benefit for the facilities they own and operate. So it's challenging to build the local case for federal facilities when the structure of the federal government is not set up to hear and consider the local need. Nevertheless, I would like to mention my colleague previously who was on the commission, Commissioner Tootie Smith. She did a fabulous job in rallying stakeholders together to move and with forward with this desire to get the locks repaired and reopened. For example, there are 19 resolutions of support for the repair and reopening of the locks, including 9 cities, 4 counties, and 6 additional stakeholders, the Willamette River, including Metro, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Grand Ronde Tribes, the Willamette Falls Heritage Foundation, and your very own Senate Joint Memorial 10 from 2015. My point is this. Clackamas County is where the locks live, but the benefit of a repaired and reopened locks is a Willamette Valley issue. Actually, I would say not just that. It is a statewide issue of, I think, local and national significance. And that's why I believe a state commission is best suited to advocate for the locks while the Corps completes their disposition study. Please support Senate Bill 256, and I will do one better up on my dear friend and colleague, Representative Kennemer. He'll take you on a boat, but I can take you kayaking right up to the locks if you want a little exercise. So thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I believe we have a date for that, do we not?
Do we?
Yeah.
Well,
we can't wait for the next offer.
Oh, okay. We'll take you on foot, too, if you want to just tour the site.
Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, I'm Russ Axelrod. I'm the mayor of West Lynn, and on behalf of the city of West Lynn and my West Lynn Council and many other cities along the Willamette River, I'm here to express our strong support for Senate Bill 256. As a councilor and mayor, I've been assisting heritage issues for the area as a member of the Willamette Falls Locks Working Group and a board member of the Willamette Falls Heritage Area Coalition. I was also had the honor of being appointed by the governor to the Willamette Falls Locks Task Force this past year. I'm also a professional geologist with added interest, expertise, and perspective on the river corridor history and its region. As Senator Olson pointed out, the locks were built in 1873 to allow passage around the falls on the West Lynn side of the river, thankfully. They represent a significant historic resource, as many have mentioned, in this unique corridor, and are an essential part of our history of both the city, the region, the entire state, and really the Western United States. These locks, as everyone has pointed out, present tremendous opportunities for economic development through renewed commerce and trade, through tourism, through enhanced recreation for Oregon and visitors of this great region. West Lynn is working with our citizens, tribal representatives, surrounding cities, businesses, and many others to revitalize the Willamette Falls area and the river corridor activity from Portland upstream to Salem and beyond. We believe that a functioning lock system is critical to this work and critical to this vision for the future. I think one of the greatest attributes not yet mentioned to restoring the locks is that it will bring people back to the river to celebrate this unique location and landscape. Whether it's commerce or tourism or recreation or restored tribal practices, bringing people back to the river expands awareness, which fosters appreciation, in turn leads to stewardship and better sustainable care of the river and the landscape. As Representative Meeks noted, there's another reason, an important reason, to restore the locks. They could play an invaluable role in the event of a magnitude 9.0 Cascadia earthquake. The severity of impacts to our region from a Cascadia earthquake will likely be significant, and the recovery time lengthy, potentially months to many years. Of particular concern is the loss of vital infrastructure, including roadways and bridges. While the Oregon Resiliency Plan prioritizes seismic retrofit of the I-5 corridor, the route that may be the most reliable and accessible the quickest is the Willamette River itself. The key to having this emergency route available is the Willamette Falls locks joining the upper and lower reaches of the river. We request that you keep this in mind. The related recommendations of the Oregon Resiliency Plan and the prospect that restoration of the locks provides an opportunity for emergency response and commercial route for community recovery. The state commission to be established by Senate Bill 256 will be tasked with evaluating the repairs and disposition studies needed to reopen the locks and identify any means to future governance and operations and maintenance of the locks in a sustainable and cost-effective manner. And in summary, creation of the commission for the Willamette locks by 256 will help secure a better future for all the communities along the river and for the entire state. And West Lynn and the cities throughout the region urge a yes vote on Senate Bill 256. And I thank you for your time and all your considerations.
Thank you, Mayor. Any questions, comments? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we have Sandy Carter and batting cleanup Congresswoman Hooley. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, thank you very much for having us today. I also submitted written support on behalf of the One Willamette River Coalition, a broad interest group that supports a productive future for the locks, and for the Willamette Falls Heritage Foundation, where I'm a board member, of course, which is a Westland nonprofit that has been advocating for Willamette Falls' important industrial heritage since its founding in 2001. So I've been working on the locks for about 15 years. This is great today to be able to come to you with the Senate Bill 256 in front of you. I was honored to serve as a citizen member of the state's task force under Governor Roberts. I want to thank you and the other lawmakers who created that group and to commend you for your foresight in backing that. The products of our work during the last year come before you today, and I'm very proud of the thought and effort and partnerships that have gone into this proposal. The closure of the locks by the Corps in 2011 divided our beloved river in two, and through the One Willamette River Group, which actually arose from an earlier Oregon Solutions project, I've been proud to be one of the long-standing community voices working to broaden understanding of the importance and potential of our venerable locks. We envision a not-too-distant future at the falls where communities and economies of the upper and lower river are once again connected, and they can move people and products seamlessly around the falls, a multiple-use river once again. The locks need to be operating to be healthy. They are languishing, suffering from deferred maintenance, and are in danger of being filled in and abandoned if positive action is not taken. Thank you so much for your support of this bill and its vision. Under the structure laid out in this bill, the state, the tribes, metro, the counties, cities, businesses, endless list. Recreational communities and other LOCS advocates will flesh out and unite behind a vision of a proud, productive future for the site of the first significant navigational improvement west of the Rockies. It will lead to effective new stewardship and brighten that future for the century ahead. And I thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. Your Honor.
Thank you, Chair Byers and Vice Chair Thompson. I've spent a lot of time working on this issue as well, both as a city councilor and then later as a member of Congress. And at that time, we had earmarks, so it was a little easier to get money for things like keeping the locks open because, you know, you went and begged and looked for money, and you were able to get at some of it, not always all of it. But it was important to our community to keep that operating. Once we got rid of earmarks, and I'm not sorry that we did, except that it makes it a lot harder to get federal funds for things that I think are important to our community. And as a member, you know what your community is, you know what they need, and it is imperative that, you know, we work for those things that help our community. This is a wonderful moment in time, and we don't often get those kind of opportunities where everything is coming together. You have the heritage site on one side of the river. You have people working on the locks. We have huge numbers of volunteers and people that are interested in this. We have gotten some funding from you. Thank you very much for that funding. And I think this is the time we have to move on. The Corps of Engineers is going to either get rid of this totally, or we're going to convince them that they shouldn't get rid of it and that we need to take charge of what's happening there. With or without them, we need to keep this open. And I'll tell you why. This is such an important part of our history that goes way back. It's important to our tribes. This is how they, you know, fish for eel and salmon, and this is where they did the ceremonies with the long boats that came through the locks. And this was a time when we also were doing a lot of logging in this area, and all you had to do is look at all the logs that came through because of the locks. That's how we got it to market. Today we don't have that. Now we don't have as much, I mean, we're not doing a lot of harvesting with timber, but we do have other things that need to be brought up and down the river. And one of those, for example, there's a company in Newburgh that has concrete, and they think that 500,000 tons of gravel each year could be sent through the locks. That equals 14,000 truckloads per year. Now, anytime that anybody's been on any traffic on any freeway, you know how many trucks are on the road. And just to get rid of a few of those could, what they move, we could do through the locks. We think we can get 350 barge tows per year through the locks. So it is a matter of keeping something that's very important to our heritage. And once you miss this opportunity, we miss it totally. You've got the Corps that would just as soon not deal with it. So they would, I think, help us give it to us, or not, they'll probably charge us for it. But anyhow, we could take care of the locks. And I think this heritage area has never been developed, and all of a sudden you've got both sides of the river wanting to do this. And I think this opportunity comes along once in our lifetime, and this is the time to do something about it. I would hope that you would take advantage of this opportunity now and send it to Ways and Means Committee, where they will have a chance to look at it. We're going to have a lot of different organizations involved in this. It's not going to come from one place, But again, this is an opportunity that we have that won't be here again. So I would urge your support of this and urge your passing it on to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Darlene, do you have the support of the entire Oregon delegation?
Yes, we have gone back and talked to the people in D.C. We also have other people that are talking back there. And as far as I know, I've talked to Representative Walden, I've talked to Schrader, I've talked to DeFazio, I've talked to Blumenauer. We've covered, I think, all our bases as far as our members, but they are all very supportive of this.
It's going to take that.
Pardon?
I said it's going to take that unanimous support from our delegation.
And the two senators have been right there pushing it and trying to move this. So it is unanimous about in Washington, D.C., for the people that work for us back there and serve our needs back there.
Senator?
One additional. I'm a historian. I've taught history all my life, and I've studied the history of this area. And I should know the answer to this question, but I don't. The building of the locks, 1873, predated the building of Cascade Locks on the Columbia.
May I?
Yes.
By about 20 years, sir.
By about 20 years.
Yes.
Yep. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Donovan and Mr. Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan.
Justin, did you? Go ahead.
Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. Here with something that we hope is additive to the bill. Members of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation have fished at Willamette Falls since time immemorial. In the Treaty of 1855 between the United States and the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla tribes, it was reserved for future generations the perpetual right to fish at all usual and accustomed fishing stations. Willamette Falls is one of those fishing stations. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla along Warm Springs are the two treaty tribes in the state of Oregon. Every year, tribal members from the Confederated Tribes harvest lamprey at Willamette Falls, which is one of the last strongholds of the species in the Columbia Basin. Lamprey are one of the most ancient of first foods, and there are many oral testimonies, histories that testify to the ongoing importance of gathering lamprey at Willamette Falls. So it's prominent in the past, present, and indelibly linked to the cultural future of our tribes. So Senate Bill 256 creates the Willamette Falls Locks Commission. As drafted, it reserves one of those seats for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde community. We request that Senate Bill 256 be amended to add seats to the commission for the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla and for the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the Business and Transportation Committee, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. And I want to say that, as with the Umatillas, ancestors of today's Confederate Tribes members regularly travel to Willamette Falls. Lamprey was critically important then. It's even more important now because of its scarcity in so many streams where it used to be very abundant. Again, Willamette Falls is a usual and accustomed treaty fishing site. For the Warm Springs, that's under the Treaty of Middle Oregon, which, of course, was negotiated at the Dalles and signed at the Dalles in 1855. The lamprey is, I think you're aware, far, far below historic levels, and even far below the levels they were at 15 or 20 years ago. Hazardous material spills have played a role. I'm not going to blame oil trains for this. It's way before that. It's more trucks, but they have played a role. And I think something to consider in this, is that both tribes have extensive experience working with the Army Corps of Engineers. There are leaders of these tribes who have spent decades working with them and increasingly effectively with them. So I think it is additive to suggest this amendment, and we appreciate the committee's consideration of it. Thank you.
I thought you were also going to invite to take them to go harvest some lamprey.
It's your moment.
Anyways.
I shouldn't be doing that, but certainly Springs Fishers would be happy to entertain you with that.
All righty. Anything else? Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Justin, did you want to testify? Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you today. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. We wanted to point out just a couple things in brief to the comments you just heard earlier, Senator, so thank you very much. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde is the only modern-day sovereign tribe that originally inhabited the area of Willamette Falls. The Kalawawala people and the Clackamas, signers of the ratified Willamette Valley Treaty of 1855, and member tribes of Grand Ronde were the owners and caretakers of the falls. Since time immemorial, the Grand Ronde people have lived, fished, gathered, worshipped, and traded with their neighbors at the falls. It remains a sacred and culturally important place to the tribe and its members to this day. We hear Warm Springs and Umatilla loud and clear, and we respect their opinion. The reality is, this is a small commission that needs to make decisions. We have been a part of the task force. We have continually been a part of this process. We value and respect their voice. That's why within Senate Bill 256, Section 4, and I believe it's D, there is a advisory group that includes other tribal folks and other recognized tribes from around the state to be involved within the process. We would certainly never ask to be the primary tribe on a commission or a project within Umatilla County, or the primary tribal government on a project within Wasco or Deschutes County, but we would want a voice at the table. And we heard that loud and clear, and I think you will see within Section 4 that opportunity exists. What we don't want to do is have overrepresentation from tribal governments, but we want other tribal governments to know that they should have faith in us to do the right thing and to bring those the correct opinions to that forum. We also know that they have the opportunity to be heard within those forums, and we think that that is a good thing. So we would ask for your recommendation to send this bill to Ways and Means, and we really do have a wonderful opportunity here. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to get that on the record today.
Thank you. Any questions of Justin? Good enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally, Chris Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Cummings, and I'm the Assistant Director for Economic Development at Business Oregon. And first, I'd like to say that we're always thrilled to hear that our stakeholders and the legislature has enough faith in our work to consider us to manage such programs as this. Should this program fall within our realm, we'll be sure to do an excellent job for our stakeholders and make sure the project works well. I would like to point out a few things about what Business Oregon does and what we do well. We manage projects and programs for businesses and communities throughout the state, primarily through our expertise in community development and economic development theories and our funding programs. We don't manage infrastructure projects. We don't have any experience or ownership of infrastructure projects that we can lend expertise to. Mostly our funding programs fall within what's known as the Infrastructure Finance Authority. That's sort of misleading. The Infrastructure Finance Authority leads funding programs for local communities and businesses. However, we don't lead infrastructure projects. As I said, if this project does fall within our department, we'll do an excellent job, as we always do, to bring it to a successful completion. I just wanted to point out what we do as an agency.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 256? Seeing none, we'll close public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 256. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 256 to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 256 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senator.
So I wanted to apologize for having to step out during the hearing. I had another committee that I had to testify in front of, but I'm glad I got back in time to vote yes. Thank you.
Any other senator?
This bill is going to Ways and Means and will probably end up on the Transportation Subcommittee of Ways and Means. I am a member of that committee. I will take very good care of it. And this will give the tribes an opportunity to continue talking. The tribes in Oregon have always worked very closely together for their mutual benefit, and I'm sure they will with respect to this project as well. We will have additional time, but I wouldn't want to see this bill held up today when it has to have a subsequent referral and then has to go through both the House and the Senate. So I will be supporting the motion.
All right. Any other comments? Senator?
I wasn't going to say anything, but I'm actually very fond of this bill, and I'm hoping it goes to Capital Construction. So the argument is, who's going to get the bill? Having said that, I want to say that I did hear something that if it does go to Capital Construction, I will ask if you've checked out alternatives to finance this plant. And I listened very intently to Senator Olson, Representative Kanemer, and Commissioner Schrader about how they use the locks and how much easier it is to use the locks. I just think people would pay to see them to use it without the locks, and that could be a very good way to make money. So,
other comments? Well, I would say to that, I was surprised to hear that they voted to eliminate tolling. We're having that discussion a lot in this session about tolling.
Oh, yeah, tolling.
Maybe that's one they can bring up again. Anyway, I will mention for the record that I did talk with Senator Devlin, and he assured me that there would be further discussions as they get down there, both in terms of where the home would be for this, and probably want to have an agency that wants it. As well as the other issues with tribal
actually
concerns.
State parks, if we financed it, and they could make...
You know, whichever you two get it, I'll let you deal with that. Further discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I see this at some point, perhaps when it's completed, is perhaps having national monument status. This is going to be so fine and so critical and such a jewel that I can see us moving in a few years once it's completed to try and get it recognized on the national map as a national monument or something of that nature, because it is the site of the beginning of civilization in this area. And it is critical in so many ways.
Apparently, we only do that at the end of president's terms.
That would be arranged.
All right. Any other discussion? Is there any opposition to the bill? There is none. Senate Bill 256 goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation unanimously and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we're closed on that one. Thank you all for coming.
Chairman, I recommend carry over 97 to 98.
That was me. And just so people will know, we're not going to have time to get to the full agenda today. We are going to carry over Senate Bill 97 and 98 and to a date to be determined. So we will open a public hearing on
Senate Bill 94, and also on Senate Bill 601. They're the same subject, and with that we're open. Patrick?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start with Senate Bill 94. Senate Bill 94 increases the threshold for the estimated cost at which a construction project must provide sanitary facilities by changing the amount that triggers the requirement from $1 million to $1.75 million. The measure also allows the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adjust the threshold amount based on changes in the Consumer Price Index. The measure, as written, has no fiscal or revenue impact. Senate Bill 601 also increases that same threshold. It increases it from $1 million to $2 million as opposed to $1.75 million. And also, the measure requires the director of DCBS to adjust the threshold amount based on changes in the Consumer Price Index, okay. Mr. Chair.
So to be clear, 94 raises it by 0.75 million and says the director may revise it, and 602 raises it to 2 million and by an ability and says they shall. Okay, so we got them there. Let's see, I have Mike, well, from, where should go? Bill Newell for Senator Knope. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you all for allowing me to testify. My name is Bill Newell, and I am the legislative director for Senator Tim Knope. So this is a really simple bill. Basically, the bill will raise the threshold from $1 million to $2 million in terms of what projects are required to provide sanitary facilities. And then it attaches the threshold to the CPI and requires the director of DCBS to calculate that. And then there's some updating of antiquated language because it talks about wash basins and warm water and soap. And I think we've made a few maybe innovations in terms of sanitation, such as hand sanitizer. There are other options that maybe contractors would like to use that are maybe better given the circumstances. Current statute, like as you probably know, is currently the threshold is $1 million for the requirement to be triggered, and it also requires things like a toilet, a wash basin, soap, and warm water. I did a little history digging on this bill, and in 1975, I think the bill was actually passed, and the threshold was $500,000. And then in 1993, 18 years later, they raised the threshold from $500,000 to $1 million. So, and it's been 24 years since the threshold has been changed, whereas the previous time period was 18. So if we're going by, you know, maybe a roughly average 20 years that this needs to be changed, we're probably 4 years overdue on a change of this level. And so basically, you know, our justification is essentially that the $1 million threshold isn't realistic given the increases in like inflation and the cost of doing business. And so to realign that back to what it was intended to be, we would just want to raise it to $2 million or something at least similar. And that would put us back on track with the every 20 years changing it. And then the reason why we would want to place the CPI indexing on the bill is basically so that we don't have to come back here every 20 years to even deal really with this, that it'll raise on its own and that, you know, we'll never have to really talk about it unless it becomes a major issue for different contractors. And then the updating language basically, instead of requiring a wash basin, soap, and warm water, it allows for sanitation facilities that maybe that are alternatives. The language seemed a little out of date and things like that, so we just wanted to update that. So that's as far as the testimony I have on the bill. It's very simple, nothing scary or crazy. So if you have any questions,
what's outdated about warm water?
Well, I mean, there are different options. Maybe that, you know, there's things like hand sanitizer because they were trying to help construction workers sanitize their hands. Maybe they're working on a dirty job and they want to be able to make sure that they're not going to transfer, you know, germs to other people. And so it gives them that option. But I mean, ultimately, that's going to be something that is up to the contractor and things like that. So, yeah.
Okay. Senator Durant?
Yeah, I have a, thank you, Chair Beyer. The question I have is a real simple one, and this goes back to the original bill. Why is it by dollar amount and not by crew size?
So that's a really good question, and I'm not sure why historically they chose to do it by project size versus the number of employees. And that may be a better way of doing it. Our thinking was in line kind of with the idea that it has kind of gone on these incremental steps in the past, so it seemed to be working at least temporarily for like 20 years time spans. So, I mean, I think people would be amenable to something like that because if you're having more people, generally they're going to be maybe needing more facilities and they're going to have opportunities that they're going to need to sanitize or things like that. So I don't know the answer why they chose that in 1975. I was born in 1990. So I would really like to know the answer. That's a really good question. But so, I mean, that I think we would be open to amendments that would say that. But, you know, I think there's another bill that's also having a public hearing right now that they want to raise the threshold. So it seems like there is a justification for having the cost of the construction project be the determinant. But maybe they can elucidate more.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Michael Wood. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we normally just refer to as Oregon OSHA. I won't go into the background because that's already been well covered in the previous comments. I am here to support Senate Bill 94. It would raise the threshold, as indicated, to 1 3/4 million. Basically, that is the CPI adjustment over the 22 years since it was last adjusted. In addition, it would give us the ability, as Mr. Brennan noted, it would allow us to make adjustments in the future. One of the differences between SB 94 and SB 601 is that 601 would mandate that. The CPI changes every year. I'm not sure that we actually want to do rulemaking to adjust this threshold and impose a different set of requirements that contractors need to learn on an annual basis. That's part of the reason that our provision was written in as permissive, so that we could adjust it when it seemed appropriate rather than having something that would be triggered every time there was a change in the CPI. The other significant distinction other than the relatively modest difference in the thresholds, the other distinction between the bills is that SB 601 would actually change the underlying substance of the requirement. Our proposal does not change the substance. We don't have a position with regard to the underlying substance. It was originally pursued, my understanding, by the building trades. I would note that in the absence of this requirement being triggered, there are requirements for toilets and certain sanitation facilities on construction sites. The significance of this requirement is the flush toilets and then the warm water hand basins. And in fact, our requirements for the presence of toilets, which frequently are met with chemical toilets, are based on the number of workers on the site. And that is a sliding scale based on the number of workers present. And that's what is triggered by that. This is a requirement separate and apart from that. And I would speculate that the reason it was triggered to a financial threshold was it was seen as an issue of the capacity of the job site of the contract to absorb the additional costs that would be represented by bringing in some sort of flush toilet option. And I'm open to any other questions you may have.
Approximately how much is it for a porta potty to be brought in?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, that's a good question. For a chemical toilet, I actually haven't checked the cost recently. For the option with a flush trailer, it depends obviously on the location. With the my staff have taken a look at that, and on a multi-week basis, it amounts to a little over $10 a day.
Mm-hmm.
More questions?
I guess I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So when you go check out these facilities, what? How do you instead of so if the project was $1 million or $990,000 or $1,002,000, how do you know whether you need flush toilets or just regular privies?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, that's a good question. We look to the estimated project cost that is available from the owner or from the prime contractor on the site, and that's what we rely upon. And that's what the requirement's actually designed to be triggered by, is the anticipated cost. Okay. So if there was a situation where, under the current rule, where it was anticipated that the cost was going to be $950,000, and there were some cost overruns, and it ended up costing $1,200,000, that wouldn't actually have triggered the requirement, because the original anticipated cost is what determines whether or not the requirement is triggered.
Okay, thanks.
So I assume the numbers, they're probably original assumption is these are going to be larger commercial projects?
Chair Beyer, yes, I think that is the notion, that they would be larger commercial projects, and not even typically multifamily stick-built residential. I don't think we're intended to fall under it. Obviously, at the million-dollar threshold, it's certainly possible that, depending on the location, that a single fourplex unit might actually trigger that requirement, and that's one of the things that we run into here, and one of the reasons that we looked at adjusting it. In the past, the department, even when it's been adjusted in the past, that wasn't actually at the department's request. But we had several bills this year where we were basically looking at dollar figures that had been written into statute that were in need of update, and this is one of those that we identified, and that's why we brought it forward.
Hmm. Is there something special about these more complex toilet facilities that makes sense in those? I'm trying to understand. You know, most construction projects, it seems like, just have the typical porta-potties on them.
Chair Beyer, I would have to speculate about the rationale behind the underlying requirement, and I think it's an issue. There's probably an added measure of health when the toilet actually flushes, and certainly when you have warm water hand-washing facilities. I think it's also an issue of comfort and dignity is part of the underlying requirement. It's, as I say, it's not actually a requirement we imposed, although it's one that we enforce.
Does the size specify how many you have to have?
Chair Beyer, no, it does not. And, in fact, it's not unusual to see sites that use a combination of trailers that come in with the flushing toilets and the plumbing for sinks, and then sprinkling chemical toilets around the facility so that they're nearer to various workers on what's generally a fairly large site, allowing them in essence a choice depending on the particular circumstances.
Sounds like it's more, the requirement is less than what probably most contractors want to put there anyway.
Chair Beyer, that's certainly possible. That isn't something I'd really be able to address.
Yes, Senator.
I guess I should ask the question, how much does it cost for a trailer then per day?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, depending on the particular configuration of the trailer, whether it has the plumbing for the other units, it can vary considerably. I can get back to you with more detail on the costs.
I'm having a hard time figuring out the rationale for this, but especially with hand sanitizers now that probably are just as good, if not better, than soap and water. So, do you have any feelings towards that, or
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I'm a safety professional, not a health professional, but my understanding of the literature is that soap and water is still a superior hand sanitizing technique to hand sanitizers, and generally in the context of our rules, we view the chemical hand sanitizers as an interim measure or a stopgap measure that is certainly superior to anything we had before they came along. In addition to that, a lot of the soaps that you'll see now are themselves germicidal, so they give you the effect of the hand sanitizer, plus you get the cleansing effect that goes with water and with scrubbing.
I guess I'm trying to figure this out. You obviously have, by rule, the number of facilities, number of toilets that you would have there. Do you read into this that however many you have to have that they all have to be flushing toilets?
Chair Beyer, no, we do not.
Okay. So they could have, if your number called for them to have five, you could have one of them that was a flushing toilet with the sinks and that, and the other four would be just regular chemical toilets, and that would meet your requirements?
Chair Beyer, I believe the answer to that is yes. I will double-check the exact way that the rule plays out and follow up with you to make sure that I've got it exactly right.
Okay. Others? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Anybody else want to testify on this? Don't see any. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 94 and Senate Bill 601. You ready to move one of these?
I have some questions about this.
Do you want to hold off on it?
Well, the question is, first of all, the need.
The what?
The need, and why it's not on a size of crew. That makes no sense to me, that it's dollar-based and not crew size.
I think I heard him say that back in the 70s, this was kind of like requested by the trade unions.
Yeah.
Well, I don't care who requested it. I'm just looking for the logic of the statute, the original statute.
Okay, we're going to carry these two bills over to allow the senator to get his questions answered. And we'll bring it back next week.
Okay.
Or if you're going to do an amendment, let me know. All right, so we won't open a work session, and we will move on. We have one more, right? 96?
Yes, sir.
So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 96 requires broker-dealers and state investment advisors with discretionary trading authority or custody of client funds to maintain an errors and omissions insurance policy in the amount of at least $1 million as a condition of Oregon licensure. We have a dash one amendment, Mr. Chair, that removes the exception for broker-dealers or state investment banker advisors, rather, that lack discretionary trading authority or custody of client funds. With the dash one amendment, there is no fiscal impact or no revenue impact for the measure. Mr. Chair, this measure did come to us with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Judiciary. I suspect that is something that the Senate President's office put on for a reason, but I have not been made privy to the reason that was added to that, Mr. Chair.
It's an odd one, yes. But that's what they put there. Okay. All righty. So we're going to start off with Laura Kelly Robinson. And it looks like, I don't know, the Telebaugh?
Aaron Teverbaugh. I'll introduce in just a minute.
Okay. Interesting spelling, Aaron. Hadn't seen that one before.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. May we start?
Please.
Excellent. Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Thompson, I know, has left us, but members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I am the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with me, I have Aaron Teverbaugh. She's a senior policy analyst also with the division. And we're here to talk to you today about Senate Bill 96, which relates to requiring E&O insurance for investment advisors. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about kind of what the background is on this, and then Aaron will talk walk us through exactly what the bill does. So under current law, we in the Division of Financial Regulation have authority over investment advisors and broker-dealers, and the current state law requires investment advisors and broker-dealers to have a $10,000 surety bond or irrevocable letter of credit in order to be licensed with us. And so this is, done as a matter of protecting the consumers that they serve. But as I'll explain, this isn't really serving its full purpose. A typical small to medium-sized investment advisor firm manages something in the neighborhood of $10 to $20 million in invested funds. Some actually have discretionary authority to trade on behalf of their clients or have custody of client funds. And once we license them, the investment advisors and broker-dealers are examined by us and subject to our oversight. And we do catch compliance issues and things that come up during the exams, but there have been examples of issues related to mismanagement, violations, or breach of fiduciary duty that have come to light other than through an exam process. And in some of those instances, we've found out about it at a time where the money was gone, and really there was limited ability to make the consumers whole. And you can imagine that $10,000 surety bond really doesn't go very far. And often in these situations, we've got a couple of specific examples where we took action and issued a cease and desist order in the last couple of years. One in 2016 with Iris Capital Management, 50 investors lost over $5 million. And by the time we issued the cease and desist order to try to attempt and also go to receivership to try to salvage some of those funds, we really weren't able to recover much on behalf of those investors. Similar examples really crop up in many cases, both here, in terms of what we regulate at the state level and also that's regulated nationally by the SEC.
96.
So we are proposing that we establish an error and omissions insurance requirement that we think will provide some better security for the consumers who place their trust in these investment advisors and broker-dealers. And I'll ask Aaron to talk a little bit about some of the details of the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Tieverbaugh. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation. One thing when we were looking at how to kind of address this backstop was the authority that we already have in statute. And we have the authority currently to be able to raise the bond to $100,000. We looked into that as maybe something else we could do instead of requiring errors and omissions insurance. But for cases like this, it turns out that would be cost prohibitive, and it would be almost impossible for most firms to be able to obtain that. The way that bonds work is you have to put in the funds to have that available there. And so it would require even really small firms to put in these funds, and depending on the level of credit and whether or not you had any disciplinary issues in the background, it just wasn't going to be available. So we also looked at capital requirements. That was not deemed to be as cost-effective as the errors and omissions insurance. Most broker-dealers and many registered investment firms already have errors and omissions insurance as a best business practice. It's about $2,000 a year, depending on credit, depending on the amount of funds under management, and depending on the history of claims against that insurance. It also protects the firms on the back end because it comes with a legal defense coverage. And so the errors and omissions insurance was kind of the best possible option we could find for the backstop.
Let me ask you a question. The situation you described earlier, what would that have helped in that instance?
Chair Byer, so the situation where we had we had issued a cease and desist order, it could have helped. I think one of the key issues is that insurance doesn't cover instances of fraud. And so if you have a firm where they're able to successfully argue that it was mismanagement or other kind of difficulties, but not outright fraud, insurance would be a reasonable way to protect that. But that is always going to be the issue that you run into. But it would have certainly been, I think, more of a feasible option and provided more coverage if it were not considered an act of fraud.
Okay.
So the bill really is fairly simple. It requires, as drafted, errors and omissions insurance of a minimum $1 million for investment advisors, state-registered investment advisors, and state-registered broker-dealers. There is an amendment in front of you that would take out the triggering conditions of having custody of funds or discretionary trading. That came to us from stakeholders and internal advice, is that really most investment advisors and broker-dealers have some level of discretion or some level of custody of funds.
And Chair Beyer, if I may add one final thing, and then we're happy to take your questions. Just following up on your question about, you know, would this be helpful in all instances? And so I think, you know, it's difficult if you'd run into true fraud to really fully guard against that, other than using the methods that we have to regulate these entities at the front end. And so that's where we really have to rely on our background checks and the licensure and our exam process. And so we do those things, but we also, separate from this bill, we're going to be talking about this in our Ways and Means hearing next week. We're actually requesting funding to be able to add a safety and soundness exam for our investment advisors to help us address financial issues that are going on with investment advisors more proactively. So that we're not specifically requesting that in the bill because we have the authority to do that, but we just wanted to express that there's kind of a two-pronged approach here, but this specific bill would be necessary in order to add the insurance requirement.
And the reason for the Dash 1 amendment?
When we were looking at what kind of benefit the restrictions, so the trigger with having custody of funds or discretionary trading would offer to investors, we found that there really wasn't any benefit to exempting folks who didn't have custody or didn't have discretionary trading, because there's sort of a de facto trust and issue there. So,
okay. Any other questions, Senator?
Yeah, I have one. And maybe you stated it and I just missed it, but it seems like we're treating in-state different than the large multinational corporations, and that just seems like a barrier to entry for me, for the in-state people. You're putting requirements that are much higher for those that are in-state than those that are either out of state or just a national firm. Can you answer that question? Why are we doing that for just our in-state guys, when we can't really impact the out-of-state people?
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, excuse me. We don't have authority over SEC-registered broker-dealers or investment advisors who have more in management than $100 million. So we simply lack the authority to be able to require them to do that.
But don't you think that is unfair, then, for those that are just a small startup company within the state?
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard. I don't consider it a barrier to entry because we went with the lowest possible option. Currently, if there's a barrier to entry to them, it would already be existing in the $10,000 bond in order to get at the just even have licensure or registration through the division. So there are FINRA requirements for capital. I was going to say capital gains. It's not capital gains. For net worth, and FINRA does examinations. The SEC does examinations. And so the larger brokerage firms, the larger investment advisor firms, are really kind of protected under federal law, and we just don't have authority to do so. So we don't mean it to be a barrier to entry, but we do mean it to protect Oregon investors.
And Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, just to add to that, I do think it's important to note that we're certainly mindful of that, and we want to make sure that we have a level playing field, and that was why we looked for kind of the most cost-effective way to go about this. But this is really a best practice for many investment advisors. So we're, from the research that we've done, we've not found that this is, an onerous requirement to add for most of our investment advisors and broker-dealers, that many of them, as a matter of running their business and managing their own risk, are procuring this kind of insurance. It's pretty typical for financial professionals in a number of capacities, but our our purpose in coming here is trying to make that a requirement and make it more broadly to make sure that we are, that we're really building on that best business practice in order to protect our consumers. And I would imagine looking at some of the larger investment advisors and broker-dealers that are SEC regulated, they're also likely carrying E&O insurance as a matter of best practice.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Banks and I think it's Tuttle, Victoria Tuttle. Did I say that wrong?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Oh, and bring in Doreen with Ryan. Doreen Ryan as well.
Chair Beyer, if it's okay with you, maybe I'll just sit behind until they're done.
Absolutely. You can, please. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I didn't realize there were four of you together there. Okay. Go ahead. Let's start.
Chairman Beyer and committee, my name is Vicki Tuttle, and I'm here with my brother, Steve Ryan, and my mother, Doreen Ryan. I am also speaking on behalf of my deceased father, Robert Ryan, a veteran of the Korean War and retired fire chief, because I am the trustee and guardian of my parents' financial accounts. In late 2014, my now deceased father was beginning to show increased moderate and late stages of dementia. As I began taking over the role of handling his finances, I discovered that his financial broker had been taking advantage of my mother and father's accounts by increasingly trading their nest egg in aggressive manner while also taking high commissions for each transaction. Excuse me, this is my first time doing this.
That's fine. Take your time.
As soon as I took note of this, I asked my broker to look at their statements to see if the activity, another broker, to see if the activity was normal. He immediately told me that I should contact DCBS, Oregon Department of Consumer Services. After consulting with others, we, my mother and brother, also decided to file a complaint to FINRA, the Financial Industries Regulatory Authority, to investigate if there was wrongdoing. In order to make a proper case, it was necessary to also have an analyst look at the accounts and history over about an 8-year span of trading to validate the claim that we were making. This was done at our own cost of about $20,000. Early in this process, my father passed away, which added to the stress of bringing this case, but also the importance of it so that others could not be taken advantage of these wrong practices. The process took over a year, as the broker would agree to hearing dates and then at the last minute ask for postponements. He went through three attorneys, two of whom ceased to represent him. We finally went to arbitration early last summer, and the three arbitrators that oversaw the case ruled in our favor. What I understand is also pretty difficult to have happen. The broker stated at the conclusion of the hearing that he had been fairly heard and would accept the decision as fair. After the award was published by FINRA, he refused to pay, and evidently he carried no insurance. He then tried to have the award nullified in the state, in the local courts, but did not prevail. He continued to say that he would not pay. To this date, we have not received a dime for the damages that were incurred. This has put an enormous strain on our lives the past 2.5 years, and especially a big stress to my mother. We bore all the costs to bring this case to justice, but in the end, the broker had not made good on the decision the arbitrators made. It is for these reasons that I would like to see Senate Bill 96 become law to protect consumers from these things that we're not as well aware of what their requirements are to be licensed and to handle our monies. Thank you, Chair Beyer.
Thank you very
committee.
Much. Whoever's next.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair and committee members, my name is Steve Ryan. We are the face of what can happen if there isn't protection for customers. As my sister explained, we had a broker that actually handled our entire family as separate units. And as Vicki became aware of what was going on with my parents, we started looking at our individual accounts, and we ran some financial investigation into what was going on. And what we discovered was that, and this is what we brought to the attorneys, we thought we were victims of churning. They were turning over the accounts extremely fast, and the commissions, rather than the typical 1 or 1.5%, averaged between 10% and 16%. Wow. So what happened over that time period, we wound up suing for close to $500,000. We went through the arbitration process, very interesting if you've never been through one, but much like we're doing right now, we sat in front of a panel of three, and they decided unanimously in our favor. And like Vicki said, our broker agreed that he had been treated fairly, and we have not seen a dime. He's tried to file bankruptcy. He's taken it all the way to the Supreme Court that he hasn't been treated fairly. Early on when we met with him and we had concerns, he assured us he had $25 million worth of insurance. He could walk away and we didn't have to fear that we were going to be covered. It was a lie. He has no insurance, and now we're left not only with the loss that we took, but the costs of all this whole court proceeding and everything, or this arbitration proceeding. So we're in front of you guys asking that you consider the fact that there are faces to what I consider a crime, and there should be some protection. I've got family members that were contractors. They have to be bonded. How can these people be in business without some sort of protection for the customers? So please consider passing this bill. We're the face of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you wish to speak, ma'am?
No.
Okay. Appreciate it. Any questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming down. Sir, would you want to speak? Yeah, well, he's up here.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard. I'm here to also testify in support of Senate Bill 96, which, as you know, would require...
Sir, could you put your name on the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Robert Banks, and I did submit some written testimony as well.
Okay.
The bill would require broker-dealers and investment advisors in Oregon to carry $1 million of liability insurance. I have worked on investor issues for the last 30 years. I am an advisor to FINRA, the Financial Industry and Regulatory Authority, back in New York, and they are the advisory board that oversees every broker-dealer in the United States. I'm one of 15 members of a committee that advises the main FINRA board on how different rules should be enacted and applied. And so I have a good deal of knowledge about what happens and what the regulations currently are. I'm also a member of good standing of the Oregon Bar. I've been a member since 1982, and I have spent most of my practice representing investors who have disputes with people in the financial services industry. And in fact, I was the attorney for the Ryans and Ms. Tuttle who were here, and I think they fairly accurately explained what happened to them. But just to be clear, what happened with Mrs. Ryan and her late husband was that for many, many years, their accounts were traded so frequently that the average that they paid per year was 16.6% of the total value of their accounts. And so there, of course, is no way that you can make money, and it's almost impossible that you wouldn't lose money over that period of time. The money that they said that they spent on this case was to pay analysts who had to enter every single trade that had happened during all that time to figure out just what all of these costs were, because when you looked at their statements, there were so many trades, a normal person couldn't figure it out. And that's the evidence that we came to the three-member panel of FINRA with. And they, as the Ryans and Tuttles told you, they found unanimously in our favor, and they awarded them over $400,000, which was basically a return of just all of the commissions that they had paid. As they told you, they haven't received any of that money, and the advisor that they had has absolutely no insurance and has refused to pay. And I see these things happen time and time and time again. And these circumstances that surround these kinds of losses can take a lot of different forms. Sometimes they're honest mistakes. For example, I've seen cases where an advisor who was a good advisor just mistakenly withdrew money at a client's request out of an IRA account when it should have been out of a joint account, and it triggered taxes and penalties with the government for premature withdrawals. Cost the client a lot of money. It wasn't the broker's intent, but it was a problem, and it did need to be addressed. And sometimes in those situations, not very often in those kinds of cases, but sometimes there's no insurance. There are other cases that are a little bit more circumspect, cases like the Ryans, where there is churning and the main intent of the account is to generate excessive commissions. There are cases, many cases that I have seen, where elderly people are sold private investments that are very high-risk investments that turn out they're illiquid. They can't be sold in the public market. They turn out going bad. And these are for seniors that maybe put 25 or 50% of their entire net worth into these investments at the advice of their advisor. They have very good cases, but they have no way to recover because these people don't have any insurance. You know, we have very fair and balanced securities laws in Oregon, I believe. There are provisions that benefit both sides, both the financial industry side and the customer side in different circumstances. But there are just many times when there aren't any recourse for investors who, even after they go through the process and the arbitrators of the courts apply the law to the evidence, and they prevail, and there's nothing for them to gain. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that I put in my written testimony back last year in 2016, and I put a citation in there, and that article shows that last year, in 2014, there were $42 million worth of FINRA arbitration awards that went unpaid nationally. That's a pretty big number. And that's really only the tip of the iceberg, because I can't tell you how many times people have called me with a serious investment problem, and I advise them not to spend money to pursue it because, in my view, the likelihood that they would win is high, but the likelihood that they would collect is very low, and it's just not worth spending your money to do it. And I have to be the bearer of bad news and say, you know, you should call the state and see if this person's license can be taken away, but I don't think that you're ever going to see your money back.
If they get an award, can they not file a lien against their assets? Yeah.
It can become a judgment, yes, but oftentimes the advisors, and as I think the people from the state said, most advisors are responsible people, and they do have the insurance. It's just a percentage, but it's a significant percentage that don't. And yes, once you have a judgment, you can lien their homes if they have them. Oftentimes, they're not in their own names. Not many times, but in the Ryan's case, a bankruptcy is filed that makes it very difficult. And I can tell you, after years, little or nothing comes out of it. We lawyers in Oregon have to have liability insurance. Doctors have it. Accountants have it. People who drive cars have it. And people in the financial services industry are a rare exception in the professions that don't have to have it. And that just doesn't seem right to me.
Sir, I'm going to ask you to to sum it, I'm running out of time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And I've got one more person.
Yeah, so to sum it up, I just think that this is a problem that is a recurring problem. There's a fairly easy fix. I think a responsible investment advisor or stockbroker would have insurance anyway. This would simply require them to do so.
Okay. And Senator, do you have a question?
Yeah, the question I have is, it appears to me that fraud was involved in the Ryan's case.
I would say so.
Okay. So the question then obviously is, does your errors and omission insurance apply when fraud is involved versus a bond where it would? So that's one of the questions I'm kind of struggling with is, errors and omissions to me is just exactly what they say, or the example you gave where he drew it from the wrong fund and it triggered a tax event. This to me is blatant fraud, and I question if the insurance company would pay on errors and omissions.
Well, the way that Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, the way that that works normally is that the claim is made against not only the advisor himself, but the advisory firm where he works. And yes, while there may be fraud by the individual advisor, the claim against the firm is a negligent failure to supervise and oversee that person's conduct. And so the insurance does apply. Not to the individual, but to the firm.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
And lastly, I have Gary Byrne. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee. I think most of it has been said already. I would like to touch on a few points. My name is Gary Byrne. I've been doing this for 40 years. A lot of investment fraud cases, elder abuse cases. To answer Senator Girard's question about the insurance, even if the insurance has fraud exclusions, in most cases you can find ways that the insurance company does have to cover it. You can have a negligence claim, a churning claim like was described in the Ryan case. You usually can get coverage for that. So it makes a big difference to have the insurance policy in place.
Is that better than a bond? A bond.
Well, a bond can be even harder to get, I think. I'm not completely sure, but there's also exclusions on bonds. But it's a rare case where the insurance company can get out based upon a fraud exclusion. Okay. It does happen, but it's very rare.
Senator?
So in the case of the folks that came up and testified with this, if this had been in effect in the hopper, and this is how we're operating, would they have been able to go after that, the insurance? Would this have covered them?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I don't know the facts of that case in detail, but based upon my experience, it'd be pretty likely you could get the insurance to cover a churning case like that. That a lawyer could make the claim in negligence, it could do something to get the coverage. The insurance company also might be paying defense costs, even if it's fraud, and therefore want to settle. So it would make a huge difference. And what's happened is, and one reason why this has come up more recently is that you do have cases where there are very small investment advisors. It's easier than it was to set up shop. And these are the people that are not supervised. That don't have compliance, don't have a broker-dealer behind them, but they might be managing millions or tens of millions of dollars without insurance, and then something goes wrong, and there's nothing to cover it. And it's invariably the bad actors who don't have assets and don't have insurance. So that's why this is so important, because as the people from the state testified, it is best practices to have the insurance.
Mr. Chair, one very quick question, if I may.
Senator Riley.
You mentioned, and it was mentioned before, that E&Os typically cover defense as well. And that point was, I think, one of the reasons you think that they would settle quickly. Is that correct?
Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I think that would have an impact more about it.
We'll move on.
There isn't a rep here for.
Other than that, I don't have anything to add. I've submitted written testimony.
Thank you very much.
And I think this would be a very important bill for investors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 96. Mr. Rescher.
I move the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 96.
Senators move the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 96. Is there any opposition to that? There's none. Dash 1 is adopted. Senator?
I move Senate Bill 96 with a Dash 1 Amendment to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Judiciary Committee.
With the due pass?
With the due. Well,
yeah, due pass.
Due pass.
Okay. Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 96 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass, subsequent referral to Judiciary Committee. A discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? There is none. The bill is moved to the floor with the due pass with the subsequent by unanimous vote. And we are closing the work session. And
Mr. Chair, we have one more piece of business. If we have time to do some bill introductions, Mr. Chair.
We will. We'll open for purposes of work session for purposes of bill introductions.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts to be introduced as committee bills. LC 1274. Do I have to say the date of thing?
No, we're good.
LC 1275, LC 3146, LC 3657 with the normal, what do we call that, that Senator Gerard likes?
Just introduced.
Okay.
With the standard disclosure that this voting to introduction does not commit you to vote for the bill. So the senator has moved Senate Bill, Legislative Concept 1274, 1275, 3146, and 3657 be introduced as committee bills. Discussion?
Can we take off the I got off of that committee, so I wouldn't have to hear that.
There you go. You may not. Is there any opposition? There's none. The bills are introduced. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.